from any source. No amount will be borne by any federal agency or department. So this paragraph really says prohibition on government borrowing specifically by the executive branch, Congress, because Congress has accepted down here, rule of construction that's constitutional. Is that right, Joe?
Yeah, I do. I think that is right. I think that's why it's there, because the Constitution. They gave the Congress both the authority to create the money and the authority to borrow, and then Congress passed the authority to create the money over to the private banks, and I'm going to call it the burden to borrow was kept for the public, and all this is saying the Treasury, the government cannot borrow after the purposes of this act, because we put the in lieu of borrowing provisions in there. But to say that, with the Congress being the part of government and the Congress being given the provision to in the Constitution to borrow on the credit of the United States, that we can't negate that authority. That's what I think. Yeah, that's what it is.
Right.
Right, Paul.
I guess at least I see this as a necessary contradiction and logical inconsistency, that it has to be there because of the Constitution. I can see no circumstances under the NEED Act where the government would ever have to borrow. It doesn't make sense to me. Maybe somebody can give me some examples. But I just think it's there because it's in the Constitution, and they want to recognize that they can't, you know, go against what the Constitution says. That's my take.
Yeah, I think you're right, Paul, but I don't see that as a contradiction, because the Section B there says essentially the Secretary and federal agencies or departments can't borrow. And C says Congress still can borrow, and it has to be there because of the Constitution.
Right.
But it's not a contradiction.
Well,
it's a rule of construction.
Okay.
Whatever.
Okay. Well, let's go on. This next section is retirement of indebtedness. So the Secretary is to retire all outstanding instruments of indebtedness of the United States by payment in full the amount legally due to the bearer in United States money, as such amounts become due. So this is the specific instruction in this act to pay off the government debt as it becomes due. That seems pretty clear. Any questions about that?
And it's likely Lucille Stack. It's likely paying it off with new money, created and spent to pay off the bondholders and security holders?
Yeah.
Or taxed?
Yeah.
But the instruments of indebtedness of the United States are United States bills and notes and so on.
Right.
I mean, that's what we're talking about here, was we're paying those off as some due.
And that, as they become due, the length of times, is it 1 year, 2 year, and 10 years?
It varies with the particular security.
Right, but are those the three options, and there aren't any that are longer than 10 years? And so.
Yeah, there are.
There are?
Yeah.
What is the length?
20-year, 30-year, and I think there are still some 40-year debts out there.
You also have municipal bonds, too, which are 30 years.
Sue Stack.
Joe Stack.
Sue, and then Joe.
So in terms of paying off the Treasury debt, couldn't the Secretary of the Treasury decide to use the money coming back from the banks in the revolving fund?
I didn't quite hear that.
Oh, am I
there?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. So in terms of paying off the Treasury debt, could the Secretary of the Treasury decide to use the money coming back from the banks into the revolving fund to pay off the indebtedness, since that would put the money back into the hands of the public?
The question is, could that be what they're going to do, how they're going to make the payment, or where, what's going to be the source of the money to make the payment for the retire and the debt?
Well, that's a possibility. Besides,
I would say it's a high likelihood.
I mean, it puts the money back, not necessarily into a working class hand. That's the only thing. It's going into the investing class.
Yeah, but the thing about that is, this is to make the monetary system work, right? And so to make the monetary system work, we're going to reduce the amount of debt upon which the government has to pay interest, right? And the people that lent that money to the government in the first place were not the common people, and not, you know, the salt of the earth, you know, that we hang out with, okay? It was the rich people. And if we didn't retire the debt, we would have to issue new debt and retire the old debt. And in either case, that money is going to go to the rich people. There isn't anything that you can really do about the fact that they own this money right now, and they have a complete legal right to get paid back, you know, for the money that they lent the government. So you're right about, this is not an income an equitable income consideration here. It's not that. It's strictly just a matter of retiring the debt so that we don't have to pay interest on it to anybody in the future.
Right. Okay.
And I would add that there is simply ambiguity in this act as to where that's coming from. It's simply not specified in the act.
Yes, definitely.
Well, it seems it leaves a lot up to the Secretary of the Treasury.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. quick question for John.
Yeah.
Are you planning to discuss the revolving fund in this presentation?
Yeah, we'll get to it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, so the next section here is the entry of United States money into circulation, and here it's the Secretary's job here. And so it's specified as through any of the following means. And the first one is essentially any act of Congress. So in response to any act of Congress that spends money, the Secretary shall cause United States money to enter the circulation. A second disbursement is to retire the outstanding instruments of indebtedness, and that's just what we've been talking about. The third is any contribution authorized by an act of Congress subject to any limitation established by the monetary authority to the revolving fund. It was curious to me, that word contribution, as opposed to, for instance, disbursement. And I don't know what the significance of that is. Is that something that you can tell us about, Joe?
Not really. Not really. That I always kind of wondered about that word myself. And I thought, like you, it sort of must mean the kind of the same thing. For instance, the disbursements of grants to the states, as a for instance, that the Congress now has the authority to issue, I'm going to say again, $500 billion. And the Congress instructs the monetary authority to actually do the disbursement of that money to the states, and in order to carry that, the Congress has to authorize it as a contribution back to the revolving fund to do that. I'm just saying it. I didn't really tie it to the part that you didn't highlight, the section 302. That's just the revolving fund part, but that was my thinking, that instead of this disbursement, which is usually for spending, whereas that's a sort of an intergovernmental transfer between the the Congress, which has the right now to authorize that money to be spent, and the monetary authority, who has, I'm pretty sure, the authority to fund the grants to the states. So maybe that's right, but maybe not.
Okay, well, let's go on here. So the next, it says any action provided for transitional arrangements specified in Title IV, including the conversion of all deposits and transaction accounts into United States money. So there'll have to be money created for that. Any exercise of lender of last resort emergency authorities under the emergency procedures. And let's talk about that under Section 305 rather than talking about it now. Okay. And then the next thing here is any purchase of stock in a Federal Reserve Bank. So this is the expenditures that are going to have to be made in the new money to essentially buy the assets of the Federal Reserve banks. And then there's a general statement that typical of all law, any other means that are necessary, basically. Okay, any comments on that?
I just have a comment back on number three about contribution, because I think the Congress can pass an authorization to add money to the revolving fund, right?
Presumably so.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Okay, well, let's continue on here. So the next thing is the reconstitution of the Federal Reserve System. And basically it says the Secretary will purchase all the net assets of the Federal Reserve System, including the banks. I suppose all their furniture. That's that section. And then this is an interesting one, however. Repayment of reserves. So, of course, the Federal Reserve Banks ostensibly hold reserves for the commercial banks. So it says here, any reserves of any member bank that is held by any Federal Reserve Bank shall be returned to the member bank, of course, in the form of United States money. This is subject to provisions contained in sections 401 and 402B. Well, those two sections, 401 simply deals with currency. I've said cash here, but it really deals with currency. And 402B basically says the monetary authority will work out how to return the reserves. So again, this is sort of left to be worked out.
I agree. I really agree about that. To me, this is really maybe the major provision in the act. To me, that I wasn't sure if I thought it really made sense because of the nature of reserves and why we need to make the money in order to make the banks whole. Because those are assets that they're holding. I really don't understand the logic actually behind that, to be honest.
Paul Stack.
Sue Stack.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, two things. Yeah, I think if you believe what Joseph Huber is saying, there is no reserve. Those reserves never had a chance to circulate in the real economy. So to now make them real doesn't make sense to me. Because if they're monetized, then they go into the real economy and they belong to the bank. It doesn't make sense from my understanding, so I need to get a better understanding. Another thing, it doesn't seem to be bothering anyone else, but it seems that really this is a little disingenuous. They're really abolishing the Federal Reserve, period. There's no such thing as reserve. So to say that it's the Federal Reserve is being incorporated into the Treasury doesn't make sense to me. It just bothers me. It's just say, you know, we're getting rid of the Federal Reserve. That's it.
Mark's back.
Maybe somebody else has some other opinions on that, but it's confusing for me.
Hold on. It's a little bit incoherent. So, Lucille made a comment. Maybe you'd like to say it out loud. And then Sue, and who was the last one on the staff?
Virginia.
Virginia, and Mark.
I don't need my comments. I think people can read it. I don't have more to say.
Do you want to just say it out loud so it gets onto the video?
Oh, sure. So it was responding to just, just that we, people who hold securities, bonds, will, as they come due, they will be paid back with U.S. money. And it might seem unfair. I think Sue raised the question, you know, that's really the very, very elite. And, you know, if there's a political revolution, that might be what people question, but I think it's legally necessary, and it will be a smoother transition. And the real important systemic change to me is that, yeah, they get paid back in real U.S. money, but after that, that money ain't gonna beget more money simply as money does today. And they have that surplus, and they're gonna have to find either productive investment purposes or consumptive ones for that surplus money. And I think there's gonna be a lot of it that is gonna go into bank deposits. And those deposits are not gonna be able to be as risky because we've taken out the artificial security blanket that allows all this money be getting money out of risky investments and all that. And so to me, it's a small price to pay. Yes, pay them off, and it's legally necessary. That's, you know, they bought the bond and the government got the money, but it's really a game changer once they get paid off and they have to actually be productive with their money. And they're going to give it to, they won't need to give it to us because we will have done our job. maybe we'll make music and anyway, that's all. Sorry, it took so long.
Good one.
Okay. I'm not sure if it was, Sue, are you back on the stack or no?
Yes. I never left.
Okay, Sue, go ahead.
Okay. So when I think of the Federal Reserve moving into the Treasury, what I think of is basically the payment system, which are all the programs that move payments, between the banks. That's very, very, it's the crux of the system. It's all done through this payment system. The other thing is, when I think of the government buying the 12 Federal Reserve banks, and you look at their balance sheet, so yes, the 12 Federal Reserve banks owe their members the reserves. So that, this took me a long time to understand. But yes, so they need to get paid back those reserves because they're owed by the Federal Reserve banks to their members. And so that gets done. But we're buying all of the shares. So we're buying the ownership of those 12 banks. So what we get a very, I think, sweetheart deal, because we get all of the securities that are the assets of those 12 Federal Reserve banks. And I think, my memory serves me right, we're buying those shares at the cost of the shares to those members. And it's not a very big cost. I think I tried to figure it out, and it was like something outrageously small, like $32 billion. And we're getting all those assets on the asset side of those Federal Reserve balance sheets. You know, I mean, I hated to give those member banks all of their reserves, but you know, if you look at the balance sheet, they are owed those reserves, you know.
Okay. Virginia, and then Mark is on the stack. Virginia?
Okay, according to the Federal Reserve itself, they have four current function areas. And as I understand it, four of those will continue and be moved into the Treasury. And the first one is the one that Sue mentioned, which is the basic banking services, providing transfer, storage, accounting for the government and for, well, I don't know if they'll be providing it for the private banks, but anyway, they'll be providing those services to the US government as they do now. The second function is that they currently supervise and regulate the financial sector, and that needs to reside somewhere. It's duplicated to some extent already in the Treasury, but that really is part of what I would think we would expect a U.S. bank or within the Treasury to do. The third thing, currently, the Consumer Protection and Fair Lending falls under, that was put into the Fed, which was controversial, and it really should go back into the Treasury. Number four is their research, statistics, and reporting, which is an enormously valuable asset, which we of course want to preserve. Then what they are not going to do, they're not going to create money, they're not going to create monetary policy, and they're not going to make economic policy. So it's those three last areas that we're eliminating, but the the other four functions will be moved into the Treasury.
Very, I agree, very right.
Right, so it's being abolished.
Thanks, Virginia.
Sure. Is it my, by the way, I was reading from my book.
Mark, you're on the stack. Mark Young. Now,
I was just going to respond to the same thing that Sue did, and just say that the reserves are actually funds held by members. That's why they have to give it back to them. So I was just going to offer, but she already said it. So
okay, John, back to you.
Yeah, I think that the fact that it said the monetary authority's got to work out this business of returning the reserves suggests to me that there was some confusion, and perhaps in the original writers of this document, it looks complicated. There's another way to look at it than those reserves, other than what has just been said. So it's going to be left to the monetary authority to work out. That's what the NEDAC says, isn't it? Okay, let's go on. Okay, we did this already. The reserves should return to the member bank. Okay, now this is the establishment of the monetary authority, and it says that it's supposed to be autonomous and independent. A little redundant in my view, but nonetheless, they want to make sure that it's the action of the monetary authority cannot be overruled by the Secretary of the Treasury. So it basically sort of says that twice in there. Okay. And then it specifies the nine public members going to be appointed by the president, and that not four, more than four of the members can be of the same political party. Remember when I showed that to my banker friend, he said, oh, that means the one person who's going to be an independent is going to control everything. It of course assumes that there can be no possible agreement between the members of the opposite parties. Anyway, I think that's silly.
But I also think it's
silly. I agree.
That it implies there has to be a third party.
I agree.
Or an independent.
We put okay. Jill Stein there.
Yeah. All right. Okay, and the full term is 6 years, and the chairperson will be selected by the president. But now let's go to the duties. Here's the nitty-gritty. Here are the duties. The monetary authority shall supply policy, establish monetary supply policy, and monitor the nation's monetary status. Okay. And it says that the next section says carry out such other responsibilities as the president may delegate to the monetary authority or that may be provided by an act of Congress. And that I've put in there in my own words, it ought to also say, or that may be specified elsewhere in this act, because, for instance, in Section 402, it talks about another responsibility of the monetary authority, namely returning the reserves to the banks. So that's a little minor thing that I think should be added there, but it's a technical point. It goes on then, and here's something we can talk about here. So the governing principle, the monetary policy, shall pursue a policy based on the governing principle, the supply of money in circulation should not become inflationary nor deflationary in and of itself. And we talked about that earlier because those words had occurred earlier, and it'll be sufficient to allow goods and services to move freely in a balanced manner. And here again, the growth issue comes out. So what's written here is monetary authority shall maintain long-run growth of the monetary and credit aggregates commensurate with the economy's long-run potential to increase production so as to promote effectively the goals of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-time interest rates. So I think all those issues we've really talked about already because the same language has occurred earlier. Is there anything else that anybody wants to add about that at this time?
Mark Stack. I was just going to mention that I do not like the political affiliation stuff. I think to me, legislation like this should look past partisanship, and people should just be qualified to do the job. I just think when you say it has to be four and four, it's, you know, everybody. Everybody doesn't have a party or something, and you know, I think the more we can move away from that type of stuff. It would be like saying that you can't have any more than, you know, four people of one on a Supreme Court or in any other form of life. I mean, I think it's something like this should move past that. But, you know, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I think parties should only have one representative each. That's not monetary.
That's a good idea, Howard. I was on the stack too. Are you done, Mark? Yeah. I just wondered about whether there should be geographic representation there, and you know, one thing with the 12 Federal Reserve banks, you know, they are geographically situated, and I just wondered why there wasn't some assurance of geographic representation.
Paul Stack.
Good, Paul.
Well, we did that with the Senate. See where that got us? So I think population might be more appropriate.
Well, it could be combined, geographic and population.
Yeah.
Virginia stick.
Virginia?
Yeah.
My problem with this is it's an old model of how good decisions are made. The idea that we're going to pick however many, 8 or 10 experts, and they're going to make a decision for the nation. And I actually take a chapter in my book to explain that we need to change the system. What the bill ought to do is create boundaries and principles for the monetary authority. And that might, for example, that might be that they are required to consider the data from all of our agencies who collect data. So they're required to consider the data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, from what the Fed does, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that consideration of all of that expert data should weigh a certain percentage in the decision making. We could ask each of those agencies to submit a report that they justify saying, oh, I think we need 1% more money. Then we should have a certain percentage of the decision making that comes from state governments. They all collect data too. So a state should submit a recommendation saying, I believe we need to increase the money supply. You know, our sense is that prices are going up or down. Create more money, don't create more money. Then why not stick it on a tax return and have a little bar where you write You know, how do you feel prices are? Are we stable? Do we not have enough? Are prices going up? Are they going down? And what the law would do is say, we require that this monetary authority take all this input from various people. And maybe the law sets the percentage and the weight of how we want them to weight it. But to some extent, they're doing a job which requires a level of expertise, but we're not making them the ones who are going to think it all through and be the experts who make the final decision.
Yeah, let me just comment on that briefly. Obviously, the NEED Act as written simply talks about who's going to be on it. It doesn't talk about process at all in terms of what the committee's doing. So this has raised another issue in terms of asking something else of the bill.
That seems to be the most important piece, though.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody else on the staff?
Nope.
Okay, let's go on. Okay, so these people are going to get paid like the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. And then we go on down here, a little farther here. And it says, now the responsibility of the secretary. Secretary shall regulate the monetary supply in reasonable accordance with targets established by the monetary authority. Then it says about reports on discrepancies, reporting anything. I got a, my own comment in here was, well, how does the secretary do this regulation? By the mechanisms of Section 201? And if that's the case, then regulation refers only to increasing the money supply. It's a question in my mind. Joe, is that something that you want to comment on?
I'm sorry, but which part, you know, which part, which part are you questioning there, John? I wasn't really sure about that.
Well,
the monetary target and the monetary supply discrepancies part.
Well, this statement that the secretary shall regulate the money supply. Okay. And my question was sort of, well, how does the secretary do this? And if it's by the mechanisms of Section 201, then regulation refers only to really increasing the money supply.
Yeah. Okay, so my take on that is regulation doesn't mean regulation when it comes to regulating the money supply. It's not by regulation. It's just really to make sure, because on the day that the budget is approved and signed by the president, the Treasury has the issuing authority for all the money that's approved. So the whole year's money is approved is sort of in the Treasury's account. And I think that all that it's saying is to try to ensure that we don't cause economic dislocations by putting out more money in even though it's for an approved project, in advance of the ability of the economy to utilize it for productive purposes, because they have that much power. They have the whole power of the purse of the Congress. And again, if it's $500 billion, they're sitting on $500 billion. And I think that the monetary authority is supposed to establish those targets with regard to I'm going to call it a 12-month average, kind of a distribution. But the secretary has to do it because they're going to authorize the payments.
What I hear you emphasizing is the fact that says in reasonable accordance with the targets established by the monetary authority.
Yeah.
Very important part of this section.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go on here. Establishment of the Federal Reserve.
John?
Yeah.
Just a quick question. Is this reference to secretary there, is that Secretary of the Treasury?
Yes.
So I thought there was a separation between the fiscal and the monetary, and I thought it was the monetary authority that was regulating the monetary supply, and that is the secretary is not in the leadership of that, is they? He or she?
Joe Stack.
Hey, Joe.
Sue Stack.
Yeah, so you're right about the monetary authority's job is to determine the supply of money. That's their job. But once they determine that, the Treasury is responsible for all fiscal operations. So all financial arrangements with regard to operating the government is up to the Treasury. So at some point, it's not the monetary authority's job to actually open and close the valve there, okay, if you will. That's the regulating part. But the targets are established by the monetary authority with regard to how much that valve should be open at any given point in time. But so I don't think that it's I think that it's a proper separation of the implementing authority to have the secretary being in actual charge of what approved expenditures in the budget get paid out when. And that's what I mean, because it says in accordance with the targets established by the monetary authority. And I think that those targets include periodic schedules of issuance. But to me, it's just not something that, you know, that I could see us being concerned about in terms of not having the confidence, you know, that a well-funded Treasury could take care of that.
Paul Stack.
Good, Paul.
Yeah, just it's a little ambiguous. If you go down to section 304, there the language seems to endow the secretary with forecasting powers as well. So it's just a little ambiguous sounding. It sounds like he's taking over some of the functions of the monetary authority. I'm sure that's not what they meant, but that's kind of what it looks like. A little further down.
Sue Stack.
Who?
I always thought that the monetary authority was strictly to say how much new money could be created by the treasurer.
Oh.
Is that not right?
Well, in terms of the money supply, yeah, that's right.
That's their major role, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Monetary supply.
Yeah. Well, how much new money each year would be created?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's different than the monetary supply, right?
Well, the amount in circulation, you know, the amount in circulation is the key. You know, that to me is the money supply. And in other words, Sue's saying, well, I think it's the increase in the money supply. Yes, it's the increase in the money supply added to the existing money supply. That's the money supply that will be in the economy for the following year.
So my question is, how do taxes figure into this? Because they have to be taken into account by the monetary authority, don't they, in some way?
I'm sorry, they have to be what by the monetary authority?
Doesn't the level of taxation have to be taken into account by the monetary authority? Since they don't decide on taxes, they have to know how much money is going to be extracted. And then...
Yeah, but you know, I mean, unless you rewrite the tax code, that's going to be an estimate, you know, because tax code will be the same as last year, and the incomes are going to be, you know, relatively the same as last year. So that's going to work within a range. I'm sure it's going to be a tight range, but it's going to still be a range. But that's not their consequence, really, I don't think. I mean, to me, when I think of it, it's what's the difference between the current level, of the economic throughput and the potential level of economic throughput, given all those other constraints that are out there, and what that difference is the amount that the monetary authority identifies.
I think it's clear that this is a general authorization of the monetary authority to look after the money supply in its totality, and it doesn't seek to tell them exactly what data they have to use to do that. It's a general authority that's given to the monetary authority. So they would have to look at taxes and a whole bunch of other things. Obviously, the writers of the NEED Act chose to go into all of that and leave that to the monetary authority to discharge the function of regulating the monetary supply.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
Okay, let's continue here. We're almost out of time here, and we haven't even gotten to the revolving fund. We'll have to make a decision here about when to cut this off, because we may want to carry this over into another coffee house. Bo Young, do you want to speak to that?
Well, this coffee house had been scheduled for 2.5 hours, but it is a school night, so we could wrap up soon. Definitely, we can definitely continue for the next one, maybe even two.
Yeah. Well, I'm open to continuing for another half hour if that's okay with other people, if that's the way you have it originally scheduled.
I am also.
Fine with me.
Fine with me.
Okay, I think
I think we're on a roll. Let's keep going.
So far behind in grading, won't catch up tonight, that's for sure.
Okay, so the next section here called is Section 303, Establishment of the Bureau of the Federal Reserve. And so it all it says is that an existing part of the U.S. Code is going to get amended. By adding the following new section, namely the Bureau of the Federal Reserve. So this tells some things about what the. It first talks about the structure of the Federal Reserve, in terms of appointments and all this kind of stuff, and then we come down here to its duties. So we get some insight into what is expected of the Federal Reserve now brought into the Treasury Department. And what it says is to administer under the direction of the Secretary the origination and entry into circulation of United States money, subject to the limitations established by the monetary authority. But here again, the Secretary and its new Bureau is going to carry out the work, but under the guidelines, subject to the limitations established by the monetary authority. Okay. Then the next one is money creation is solely a function of the United States government and fractional reserve lending is ended. I have written something in here that this is similar in function to the provision of reserves. Wait a minute. Well, never mind what I put in there. It's probably inappropriate that I stuck that in there. It's basically saying here that money creation is solely a function. And it's government and fractional reserve is lending. So if anybody else wants to comment on that, you're welcome to do so.
Does anybody know why they wanted to call it the Bureau of the Federal Reserve? Since there's no federal...
Maybe he knows.
I think that's a good question, and I would say, at some point in time, they would just call it something else, because there's no reserves involved. But now, at least, it's federal, you know. But I'm trying to understand actually if that's what John meant in terms of the Federal Reserve, that there are being reserves.
Why wouldn't it just be called the U.S. Bank? Because all of its functions, to me, seem like they're that of a banker to the U.S. government.
agree with that. I agree with that.
Yeah, it's the central bank. Central bank functions.
It's the U.S. bank. Our bank, our government bank.
Right. Okay, well, let's continue on here. Let's see. These are various details that I didn't see anything that was of enormous importance in terms of the central ideas of the Act. These are little mechanisms here, forecasting of disbursement requirements and so on. But then we get to this other section. So that takes care of this section. Now we're in a new section, lender of last resort and emergency procedures. So what it says here is that the recommendation of the president, upon recommendation of the emergency board, monetary authority may not exercise any authority under the third undesignated paragraph of section 13 of the Federal Reserve Act unless. I went back to try to figure out what the section 13 of the Federal Reserve Act, the third paragraph, did. And what it said was the Federal Reserve Board of Governors to discount for any participant in any program or facility with broad-based eligibility, notes, drafts, and bills of exchange. So you can alter the sort of payment so that they can discount them. But since the Board of Governors is to be abolished by this act, this seems to me unnecessary. However, it may be there to make sure the monetary authority doesn't try any shenanigans of offering special privileges, discounts, that is, to entities like banks, which might have borrowed money from the revolving fund. So this is just my comment and struggling to find out why this is in there. And Joe, I don't know whether you have any comments on that.
Oh, I actually was thinking along those same lines, John, in terms of it being a, you know, somewhat of an apparent constraint, you know, on the money going in and out of the revolving fund. But it's not clear. It's, you know, to me the whole thing about these emergency procedures are they're sort of the, you know, the suspenders of the question of whether there will be enough money in circulation to carry on the needs of the economy. And and I think that this is just, you know, this is just a sort of a catch-all limitation that nothing untoward is going to happen with the authority that all the authorities that the monetary authority has, and that the Federal Reserve's is not involved in that. That's how I feel about it. It's just strictly the emergency procedures and the emergency board, and that's it.
Mark's dead.
Mark, go ahead.
For me, I mean, again, I think it makes sense from the standpoint that if the monetary authority is using data to create a certain amount of money, and Congress is saying what they're going to do with that money, and the Secretary is releasing that money when the time comes, there could be an instance where certain data points don't work for the monetary authority. I mean, I'm thinking like, you know, a huge hurricane or tsunami or something like that, where it literally may cost $50 billion, and because they're not borrowing money, and that act alone or that act of destruction may, you know, equate the need to come up with some more money immediately. So to me, this is just kind of like a back door to say, look, if it's needed and we say it's needed, then you're going to do it. That's how I look at it.
But obviously, the section is designed to make this business of being a lender of last resort a pretty high bar, because you have to get together this emergency board, and to upon a vote of 2/3 of its members of the emergency board is established under this section in this way. But this is a complex. So here's the emergency board, and so this is obviously a big hurdle for the emergency support. For lending of last resort to occur. And I think my understanding of this, and my understanding isn't very good, But my understanding of this is what we have now is this business of the Federal Reserve being the specter of bank, a lender of last resorts, bailing out the banks. And that's the thing that is supposed to happen under the NEED Act. And all of this seems to be to wage fears of people that think that some bad thing is going to happen as a result of the implementation of the NEED Act. And those of us who are looking at it think those things are unlikely to come to pass. But that seems to be why this section on the emergency procedures is here.
Unlikely to pass, but that doesn't mean, I think, they have whole cities under mountains because of, the potential of nuclear war. So to me, you always have to be careful enough to make sure that, it is possible to have an economic collapse in a different economy. Something could happen. And I think the point is that if I can get all these people to agree that we need to do something, it probably needs to be done. To me, it's just I like it in there, actually. I think it's smart, and it gives people the ability to say, well, what if government messes this up and they do it wrong? What if the monetary authority does it wrong, or somebody does something wrong? To me, this is a way that you can say, okay, well, we need to fix it like this. So it doesn't bother me, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. But it doesn't bother me either. It seems reasonable. So let's continue on here then. Savings provisions and transfer provisions. And as I read it, basically says that all previously made obligations that have been taken on by the government will be up. So, for instance, down here, saying rights and duties shall not affect the validity of obligation of the United States. The Bureau is a successor to the Board of Governors or any other person, and so on. So basically, it's saying that these obligations will be honored. Continuation of suits is more of the same thing. And here is more details of the transfer of personnel from the existing Federal Reserve System into this U.S. Bank, we'll call it that, within the Treasury Department. So here, now we go into another title in which we talk about transitional arrangements. And this section 401 is under the conversion of Federal Reserve notes. And for instance, the part that I have highlighted here is that the Secretary shall begin providing a sufficient quantity of United States money to the domestic banking system to allow for conversion of outstanding Federal Reserve notes and the issuance of additional currency as required. So this is an important chunk in terms of the transition.
Well, not really. It represents about 5% of the total money supply.
But a very visible one to the public.
Yeah, that's true. But that's just a matter of, getting the designers at work and, it's time for all women on the money this time.
There you go.
Crank up the printing presses.
Right. So down here further then is replacing fractional reserve banking with the lending of United States money. And now this is talking about the deposits, and it defines now transaction accounts. So these transaction accounts are going to be the accounts that are like our checking accounts. And they are going to no longer be the property of the banks as they are under the current system. So what it says here is all deposits at any depository institution should be designated and treated as United States money as transaction accounts. Okay. So here are some prohibitions about these transaction accounts. No interest may be paid or accrued on any United States money on deposit. So if it's deposited in a bank as a transition account, no interest is going to be paid on this. Okay. This money is there as bailment. And what that means is that it's not the property of the bank. It's still the property of the person who deposited it. simply held in as bailment by the institution, by the bank, but it's not bank money. And it's here to be treated as bailment for mutual benefit of the parties and terminable at will, and that you can withdraw your money. And this is still under these.
What do you think the mutual benefit of the parties means? Isn't this isn't bailment comparable to a trust account?
Yes.
So who's the other part of the mutual?
Interesting question.
Well, I would have an answer, but I have a question first. Are transaction accounts only checking accounts, or does it also include saving accounts?
It distinctly does not include savings accounts.
Okay.
That comes later. See down below, except for long-term savings not subject to deposit insurance. That's where
savings. Yeah, that's something else, John. That's saying long-term savings. And why is there even any reference to deposit insurance? So if it included, you know, short-term savings, just normal savings accounts that, you know, not time deposit, to me, the mutual benefit is about protecting the purchasing power of that money that you don't need today, but you do need, but you don't need the numbers, you need its purchasing power. And the only way to protect its purchasing power is to put that money to good use, consumptive or productive use, when you don't need it. And that's the benefit to the person who's letting go. And you're letting go of that money if it's in savings, and you're taking a risk for it. But the benefit is that when you do need it, its purchasing power is at least as good as the time at which you let go of it. So it's very much a mutual benefit. But I don't know if it's only referring to checking accounts, then nobody else is getting any benefit of it, and it's sitting there. And if too much sits there, you know, normally you just keep kind of what you need for your monthly expenses in checking accounts. But I don't, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is up here. It's talking about the transaction accounts, okay, as bailment, and then in down here it says subparagraph B, and that's this one up here. That subparagraph shall not apply to any liability of depository institutions to a customer for any amount in account at a depository institution pursuant to a contract that restricts the availability of any such amount for a fixed term, and does not permit amounts to be transferred in any manner for the benefit of a third party. So what this says is, this is referring to savings accounts, and these are now time deposits as opposed to demand deposits. The transaction deposits are demand deposits. You can take that money out at any time. But a time deposit, you can't. You get it essentially for a particular amount of time. And that's necessary for the banks to be able to make use of that money so they know how long they have it. And they can plan then to use that to make loans. So that's the money in these savings accounts that are going to be used in the banks for lending out for their own lending purposes, for mortgages or car loans or whatever they're doing.
Right. It's still not clear to me exactly, and I have notes from before here, but what there's time deposits and there's checking, and if we say checking and transaction are synonymous, where do savings accounts that aren't time deposits, that they are basically demand accounts, maybe there's a tiny amount that you can't have access to, but you know, the vast majority of it, you can transfer it to your checking account whenever you want. And I'm not quite sure where those fit in.
I don't think they do.
Go ahead, Virginia.
Well, as I understand it, there will be the transaction accounts, which are the equivalent of a trust account, or they're using the term bailment. But there's no interest paid on that. It's there for you. No one can do anything with that. It can't be used if you're not. I mean, you could have $1 million sitting there, and you might do that if you wanted it to be 100% safe. You're not taking any risk whatsoever.
But you are.
Then you take it out of that account and come determine any set of terms of risk and time and put it into the equivalent of a certificate of deposit. Then there might be one that's very short term. You know, I'm leaving my $1 million with you for the week or overnight. But once you pick a risk and sign a contract for a time, you do not have access to it. You can't move it into your checking account. That sort of interim money market account that we have now, that has to go.
Yeah, but I mean, normal savings account are not money market accounts, but I agree with you that there is a firm difference. And if it's in savings, it's at risk. And if you're saying all savings would have certain time threshold tied to them, and so that there wouldn't be savings accounts that don't have a time factor.
Right. I mean, I don't understand. I did just switch my account to a credit union, and in the credit union, you are required to have that savings account and a checking account to even have an account with them. And then you can set it up so funds will roll from savings into checking. So, but I'm going to assume that's no longer going to be possible. The credit union will have to tie its customers down to some kind of contract in the savings account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's right, Virginia. That in the current system, there has been a lot of blurring between sort of savings account and our checking accounts and so on, and they are no longer very clearly distinguished in there. But what the NEED Act does is it distinguishes these two different kind of accounts, either a transaction account, which is a demand deposit, or it's a time deposit, and that's the latter are the savings.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I don't know if it exactly fits in here, but it's a question related to what we're saying, and that is what Virginia said before about, you know, somebody could keep, you know, their $1 million in their transaction account and it nobody could touch it. And to me, I think there is a huge cost to doing that, because that is real money in circulation that is not in circulation. It's not acting as money. And it seems to me, and I wonder if it's anywhere in the NEED Act, of that there being a threshold above which there's some kind of penalty for keeping that money in or not penalty, but there's a charge, you know, for storing liquid assets, because it means somebody in your community doesn't have that means of exchange to be productive and consumptive. And that means that the purchasing power of that $1 million you're holding on to is not going to be, it's going to go down over time because you're not in a thriving economic community. It seems to me monetary authority, that's something they would be looking at.
I think that there's a place to trust a free market. And if I stick $1 million in to my transaction account and I leave it there for a year, I've just lost that productive income that money could be producing
both for me and for the community. And I think that the number of people who have the money to just stash for another day without it earning anything at all for them is going to be very small. Most people would say, if I've got $1 million, I don't want it, I don't need it for a year, I'm going to put it in a savings account and earn something. I don't think that's going to be an issue.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, except I think it's misnomer to say that there's no cost even to you for keeping that money in the transaction account. There is a cost to you, and there is a benefit to you of making it available to others that's not about interest. It's about protecting the purchasing power of that money when you do need it. And that is a benefit, a real benefit, and people don't understand it. They think, you know, the only reason you put money in savings is to get the interest. And I don't agree with that.
I guess I don't follow it for the standpoint of, if I put money in the bank, let's just say I'm not using it, and I put money in the bank and I got $1 million in the bank and I just want to leave it to my kids. What, I guess I don't understand how that would, the description that you're describing seems like we need to be spending our money and that we shouldn't just keep it in savings for a long duration of time. I mean, what if I'm working and I just want to...
Not savings, you said transaction.
Okay, I think
in savings, then it's available for somebody else to use. But you were saying
you mean an actual transaction, an investment account? Is that what you're saying?
No, I was making the difference between a checking account. I think that's how they're using the term transaction account versus, and that's nobody can touch it. But that money from a monetary authority's perspective, that's money theoretically in the money supply, and yet it's not available. It's sitting there.
I think the monetary authority has to consider that some people are going to want to save money, and so they have to adjust that and make sure that there's still enough money supply out there.
No, if it's savings, then it's available for other people to use.
If I use the term in a transaction account, there's no cost, then I misspoke. I did not mean to say that. What I meant to say, and hope I did, was that in a transaction account, it is the equivalent of a trust account. There's no risk at all to your money in that account. It will always be there for you.
Well, the money, the numbers will be, but its purchasing power is another question.
Now you're back to the overall systemic question of maintaining a stable money. And I just don't think it's appropriate for us to want to be prescribing to people their level of comfort with risk. So if someone who wants to invest and is looking for the future will put their money in an investment account because they don't need it and they want it moving around in society, there will be a few people who may want to put substantial sums of money into a transaction account where there's no risk and it's just sitting there. But I have a really hard time imagining that there would be so many people who would do that with substantial enough amounts of money that it would have an impact on the supply and the stable value of the money in the whole system.
Robert Stack.
Okay, hold on. So we're down to 5 minutes. We will be continuing at the next coffee house. So I know Hobart and Joe are on the stack. So we'll close the stack. Hobart, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, just very quickly. So if people park their money and don't use it, the effect will that have is on the money velocity. The less people, you know, the less people spend their money, the money velocity goes down. But in the calculations, as far as I understand, of the monetary authority, they take money velocity into account. And if money velocity slows, they can counteract that by introducing more money. So if there's a certain amount of decrease of money velocity if people put millions of dollars, you know, idly away, the monetary authority kind of steps in and, you know, creates money. So it's not really lost to the community if someone just parks idly $1 million. So I don't see any reason to punish people like that too, you know, with demurrage or you know, egging them on to do something with their money. I think it's already automatically taken then into account because of the money velocity and the role money velocity plays in the equation of finding out how much money can be entered into the economy. That's my understanding of it.
Okay, Joe?
Yeah, Hoover took all of my time to explain exactly what I was going to explain.
Oh, wonderful.
And I agree with him with everything he said. But I also wanted to address, so in other words, to me, you know, none of those things are a problem. You know, the monetary authority has to be the professionals here, and they will take care of that. And then the other professionals here are the bankers, and that there is a cost to maintaining a transaction account will be paid by the person holding the account to the bank in a charge and a fee for service. We don't have to worry about you know how these things are done, how they're fair. You'll be putting your money in your bank on the basis of everything that bank does, and that includes their fees for keeping your transaction accounts going. So I don't see any problem here.
Okay, on that note, John, I'll let you have the last word, and I'll say a few words about next steps. John?
Okay. We're talking about a big macro economy issue here that involves speculation about people's behavior and a number of things. So these are hard things to pin down. One thing I would say is later on we haven't gotten to these transaction accounts. Banks will be able to charge fees for transactions because they obviously are providing a service. So although there's no interest paid, there may be charges that banks can charge for your checking account, for instance, for these kinds of transactions that'll be operating out of these transaction accounts. I think this has been we've touched upon a lot of ideas that we're going to have to revisit and think about as we think about a new iteration of the NEED Act. And we haven't gotten through it all, and so maybe we can continue this discussion on through and then figure out how to go back and address each one of these issues as we look to the future.
Yes, absolutely. So I'll just say that the next coffee house is, it's again the second Saturday and the fourth Monday. So the next one is Saturday, November the 10th at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time. We'll go for another 2.5 hours because there's a lot of meat here and it really is about finding a common baseline. So this is a very, very important process for all of us. So we will continue with this legislation at the next coffee house. What I would propose is that the one later in November, we could invite Jamie to and have more of a discussion around the implications and go over some of the necessary visions, et cetera, that this has kind of opened up. I would like to suggest, John, there's a way that this discussion is very good, and it's also very sophisticated on a very high level. So I wonder if at the next coffee house you could perhaps summarize some of the stuff that we've covered at this one in ways that regular people might understand. You know, stuff like credit aggregates and stuff some of us have no idea of. And so that might be useful just to start off the next coffee house, if that's possible.
Okay.
Super. Thanks, everyone. It's 10:30. Thanks for hanging in. And this was great. And see you at the next coffee house.
Okay, thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's great.